This is the podcast Surgery IC Rounds. My name is Jeff Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center at Vanderbilt University. Today, the topic that I want to talk about is issues of blood component therapy. It's been my observation working with residents and fellows that we order a lot of blood, and a lot of times our indications for why we're ordering the blood are very soft at that. I've done a previous podcast addressing what are the hemoglobin thresholds or triggers, or whether we should even have a set trigger point for transfusion of blood. But then when I see how people will go about and order various blood or blood products, it really indicates that we don't have a really strong understanding of when we would use a unit of blood or when it's more appropriate to use FFP versus platelets versus something like cryoprecipitate. And that's going to be the topic of today's discussion. The first issue we're going to talk about is just going over what are the various types of blood products that we use. The first is whole blood. Whole blood really doesn't get used much nowadays in a civilian practice, but certainly in the military setting, we're certainly seeing a lot of reports, particularly at meetings, of how the military is using whole bloods and having results they're very satisfied with. Basically, a unit of donated blood, which is roughly about 520 milliliters, contains both a unit of plasma and a unit of cells. Whole blood can be stored for about 5 weeks. Factors 5 and factor 7 are labile and are significantly decreased after 7 days. The indications for whole blood, particularly if used fresh, is in resuscitation of the exsanguinating patient. It's not really indicated currently in most civilian settings for, quote, the routine transfusion of blood, particularly when we can use packed red blood cells. And that's pretty straightforward, because we could take a unit of donated blood and we could break it down to a unit of red cells, a unit of platelets, a unit of FFP, and that way by doing component therapy where we have the ability to help perhaps three people, and one person who's in need of cells, one person who's in need of factor in the form of plasma, and another person who may need platelets. The setting that we're seeing this used a lot in military settings and now on the state side and some trauma settings for massive resuscitation is that a patient who is receiving large amounts of blood in a massive transfusion protocol typically needs not only just packed red blood cells, but coagulation factors in the form of plasma and platelets. And in some settings, they're doing what's called one-to-one-to-one component therapy, where in a trauma patient who is rapidly exsanguinating, they're giving it a unit of blood with a unit of platelets with a unit of FFP. What the military has learned is by using whole blood or the one-to-one-to-one therapy, that they're able to basically prevent problems with coagulopathy that we see in massive transfusions. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. The next blood product is packed red blood cells. And packed red blood cells, or PRBCs, is what is left of the red cell mass after the plasma is removed. Typically, this has a hematocrit between 70 and 80, and the volume of a unit of packed red blood cells is roughly 340 cc's. In an average adult, administering one unit of packed red blood cells will increase the hematocrit by 3%, or the hemoglobin by 1 gram per deciliter. Typically, the indications for packed red blood cells, as I've said, that could be a topic in and of by itself. We have talked in the past and in a previous podcast about thresholds for transfusion of blood. People a lot of times will have arbitrary transfusion thresholds, and the literature clearly shows that that's not appropriate. As a general rule, packed red blood cells are indicated for patients who are anemic and have reversible anemias. For people who have reversible anemias, we should not be giving packed red blood cells if we have somebody who has an iron deficiency anemia, unless they're symptomatic. And what does symptomatic mean? Well, you know, in some circles, people would say that symptomatic means they're short of breath and having chest pain. That even a simple tachycardia is not symptomatic. And I don't know that I would agree with that wholeheartedly, particularly when we look at the interaction with a patient's heart rate and with myocardial oxygen consumption, somebody who maybe have cardiovascular disease. But we need to keep in mind that we don't transfuse people based on a number. We treat physiology. Young, healthy trauma patients particularly can tolerate very low hematocrits down into the 20s, and they maintain this by increasing their cardiac output, and by doing so, they're able to maintain oxygen delivery. There's no scientific evidence that topping somebody off to a hematocrit of 30 will improve survival or wound healing in surgical patients. We have to keep in mind that when we transfuse blood, the blood that we're giving is not normal. Bank blood is not the same, does not have the same physiological properties as a patient's native blood. The example that I would use in this is comparing somebody driving a brand new Corvette to somebody who's driving a 72 Pinto. Bank blood is physiologically different. It has a lower pH. It has less 2,3 DPG. You know, I remember from your biochemistry days that 2,3 DPG is required to result in adequate offloading of oxygen in the periphery. The surgical residents, every January we give the surgery residents an in-service exam where they're asked about various elements that result in shifts of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. A move of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve to the left is bad, and a move to the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve to the right is good. And what are some of the things that result in a left shift of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve? Things such as lower temperature, decrease in 2,3 DPG, and actually a decrease of hydrogen ion concentration. That's right, alkalosis actually will cause that to shift to the left. And as the shift, that curve shifts to the left, when the red blood cell gets to the periphery, it doesn't offload the oxygen as well. Other elements of bank blood that make it as less physiological is the red cells are not as pliable. And keep in mind that as red blood cells have to go through those end capillaries where oxygen exchange actually occurs, the red blood cells have to flex in order to get down that small, narrow capillary. Bank blood is more rigid, it's more difficult for the blood to get through those end capillaries, and therefore, even though you may have mathematically improved the oxygen-carrying capacity, and maybe even mathematically improved the oxygen delivery of blood, the actual blood moving through the capillary could be decreased because now we're trying to push molasses through it by having this thick, rigid red blood cell. And this is something called hemorheology, and that's something way beyond what we're going to talk about tonight. The other element of a blood component therapy is platelets. One platelet concentrate or one unit of random donor platelets is derived from one unit of donor blood. Single donor platelet can be used to harvest platelets. One unit of single donor platelets is equivalent to about 5 to 6 platelet concentrates. Now, one platelet concentrate can raise the platelet count by 5 to 7,000. Typically, when platelets are stored, they're considered to be stunned, and it takes about 4 hours for transfused patients to be fully functional in the circulation. So again, keeping in mind that if somebody has a need for platelets and you're giving them at noon, those platelets, though they will be administered, they're not going to be really functional, or fully functional, I should say, it's about 4 hours after administration because of this stunning of the platelets. The other thing to keep in mind is that platelets are packed in FFP. And I remember a professor of mine when I was a fellow said if you have a patient who has a coagulopathy, often platelets is perhaps a good thing to give because not only are you giving platelets, but you're also giving plasma. And often we forget the fact that we need to give people functional platelets. A pool of 5 platelet concentrates contains enough plasma to have an equivalent unit of FFP. Therefore, you've got all coagulation factors except labile 5 and factor 8. Now, there's something called human leukocyte antigen or HLA matched platelets, and these are from a single donor pheresis unit that are from an HLA matched donor. Basically, we're matching, just like we would cross match blood, we're now matching platelets. Now, we should only administer or order this product if there's evidence of HLA antibodies. Now, remember always to check what's called a platelet count 15 minutes after platelet infusion. So this 15-minute platelet count. Let's reiterate what that is. If we start hanging platelets at noon, we should be rechecking a platelet count at about 12:15. And if we have a poor 15-minute count, this may be indicative of HLA antibodies, meaning that the patient's body is mounting humoral immediate response against the infused platelets. A good 15-minute count, but a poor 24-hour count is more suggestive of consumption, such as fever, sepsis, drugs, and so forth, and not indicative of an HLA-matched platelet problem. So when do we administer platelets? Well, there's no scientific basis for the old 20,000 platelet count cutoff. And this is actually something that I've actually given some of my residents a hard time in the past and in the pretty recent past. But no scientific evidence for that. Risk of severe bleeding rises only when the count is below 5 to 10,000. Now, risk of intracranial hemorrhage is present only when the count is below 1,000. And then actual risk is roughly, if you have somebody sitting with a platelet count of 1,000, the risk of an intracranial hemorrhage is about 0.76% a day. Gemmers in The Lancet 1991 1 demonstrated the rate of major bleeding at 0.07% a day when counts are between 10 and 20,000 and rising to 1.9% per day when the counts are less than 10,000. Patients who have chronic autoimmune thrombocytopenia can tolerate platelet counts 3 to 5 to 10,000 range for years without significant problems. One should order single donor platelet-phoresis products when giving patient platelets. Although not always available, use of the single donor platelet-phoresis will expose the patient to one donor instead of 6 to 8. So a typical non-single donor platelet-phoresis, the patient is being exposed to six patients who may have a potential viral illnesses and 6 patients who may have HLA antigens complicating the infusion. In patients who are expected to have multiple transfusions, such as patients with leukemia, it may be considered to give the a product through a leukodepletion filter to reduce the risk of alloimmunization. And I would say this is certainly true in any burn patient. If you're looking at a critically injured burn patient who has, you know, maybe a 60 or 70% burn over the course of their injury, the recovery, and the reconstruction, you're looking at somebody who could easily have maybe 30 units of blood because of the bloody nature of burn surgery. So again, trying to keep people as single donor as possible, you're going to reduce that risk of alloimmunization. Platelets are not indicated for stable thrombocytopenic patients with platelet counts between 5 and 10,000. Let's discuss this idea of platelet alloimmunization a little bit more in depth. Patients exposed to cells with different HLA types will develop antibodies to those different HLA types. This is something we learn in medical school. This is basic immunology, that by infusing platelets or a blood product that has a foreign antigen, it's like immunizing the patient. The body processes that foreign antigen and develops memory to that foreign antigen. Now, this is common in patients who receive previous transfusions of blood that are not leukodepleted, or patients who have been pregnant. And you can certainly understand why patients who have been leukodepleted, because the white cells are very rich in HLA antigens. Platelets carry a class 1 HLA antigen. And if you transfuse somebody who has a foreign HLA, a class 1 HLA antigen, and they've been previously immunized because of they received previous blood products or because of previous pregnancy, they'll rapidly destroy those platelets. The importance of discussing the whole topic of alloimmunization really centers on two concepts. One is recognition, and two is avoidance. Patients with HLA antibodies will often fail to have incremental increase of their platelet counts with transfusions, and this is why we do that 15-minute count. So if a patient does not have an increase in their count 15 minutes after the transfusion, they may have HLA antibodies. One can test for the anti-HLA antibodies because some patients instead have specific anti-platelet antibodies that will not respond to HLA-matched platelets. Okay? So let me restate that. You can actually have antibodies to the platelets that are attacking the platelet itself, not the class 1 HLA antigen that the patient that particular platelet has. So therefore, even if you use matched platelets, you're still going to see the recipient's body attacking the platelets. Now, trials have shown that giving patients leukodepleted blood products will reduce the incidence of alloimmunization. So patients who are not HLA alloimmunized should receive only leukodepleted products. What this is saying is if their immune system is essentially virginal, they haven't seen all these foreign antigens, let's keep them that way. Let's keep them essentially naive giving them lukewarm products. And this is easy enough to do. We should certainly strive to maintain that, for lack of a better descriptor, that naive or virginal immune status. Well, what do we do with the bleeding patient who has a refractory platelet count? This represents a really difficult problem. If patients do have HLA antibodies, one can try to transfuse HLA-matched platelets, but unfortunately, platelet transfusions are ineffective in about 20 to 70% of these patients. If a patient is totally refractory to platelet transfusions, one certainly needs to consider the various drugs as an etiology to antiplatelet antibodies, and one especially is used so widely anymore in virtually any patient, just not intensive care unit patients, and it's vancomycin. use of some anti-fibrinolytic agents such as Epsilon aminocaproic acid may decrease the incidence of bleeding. Platelet drips consisting of infusions, either a platelet concentrate one per hour or platelet pheresis unit one every 6 hours may be given as a continuous infusion. In life-threatening situations where the patient appears to be platelet refractory, certainly that's a consideration, one of the real few considerations for using recombinant factor VII. Another blood product that really gets kind of abused a lot is FFP, or fresh frozen plasma. FFP is derived from one unit of a donated whole blood. It has an average volume of roughly 225 milliliters. One unit of fresh frozen plasma can raise your coagulation factors a level by 5 to 8%, and it can increase your fibrinogen level by 13 milligrams per deciliter in the average patient. It takes about 30 minutes to thaw a unit of FFP. FFP should only be used when there's a documented coagulation defect that can be corrected by a reasonable amount of FFP. And the key word there is reasonable amount. It is useful for the patient who is overdosed with Coumadin and is bleeding or needs immediate surgery. I would tell you that many people who do trauma surgery would also say that a patient comes in and they're anticoagulated on Coumadin, and it looks like they have any kind of head injury, they really start FFP almost immediately. DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulation, bleeding is another indication for the use of FFP. FFP is used along with plasma exchange in patients who have thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or TTP. FFP may be useful in the bleeding patient with liver disease and documented coagulation defects, although most bleeding in this group of patients is due to mechanical reasons, particularly something like a bleeding varice. Patients with FFP contains things like protein C, protein S, antithrombin 3, and therefore it's used in these patients. Anticoagulation factors for patients who are deficient undergoing surgery. It's kind of a neat question, and I remember being asked that people who have an antithrombin 3 deficiency, and remember, keep in mind, heparin works through antithrombin 3, and if you're trying to anticoagulate somebody and they have no antithrombin 3, you can't really anticoagulate them. And an FFP infusion will then provide the enough antithrombin 3 to allow anticoagulation to be functional. FFP is not indicated for most of the purposes in which we actually use it. It's often used as kind of the super glue or quick fix for anybody who has any kind of general coagulopathy, regardless of whether the coagulopathy needs to be corrected or what the etiology of the coagulopathy is. This is an incredible waste of blood product, and it really exposed the patient unnecessarily to viral disease. One example of this is a stable patient with end-stage liver disease who has a coagulopathy. Assuming that his factor VII level is roughly 25% normal, it would take about 6 units of FFP, which is roughly 1.2 liters of plasma, to raise that factor VII level to 75%. Now, the half-life of factor VII is about 7 hours. So that's pretty convenient, factor 7, 7 hours. So to keep his factor 7 level above 50% would require 6 units of FFP every 6 hours, or roughly 5 liters of plasma a day. Now, to keep his factor 7 levels above 100% would require 18 units of FFP every 6 hours, which translates into 15 liters of plasma a day. Most people would feel that a PT lower than an INR of 2 is safe for surgery and procedures, assuming there's no other coagulation defect when we're trying to get people ready for surgery. But again, you know, trying to correct somebody's coagulopathy from liver disease in preparation for surgery just may not be the way to go. Now, cryoprecipitate is another blood product I see used inappropriately by a lot of individuals, and you'll see people get several units of cryoprecipitate, and the next question I'll typically ask somebody is, well, what was their fibrinogen level? And they can't tell you. Typically the indication for this, well, let's talk about this. What is cryoprecipitate? Well, cryo is one unit of fresh frozen plasma that's thawed down to 4 degrees. The precipitant is then resuspended in 10 cc's of saline, or FFP, and refrozen for storage. So you're basically concentrating the factor. And one unit contains at least 150 milligrams of fibrinogen and 80 units of factor 8, along with some von Willebrand factor. Now, cryo, again, takes about 20 minutes to thaw, so when you ask it, they're just not going to pull it on the shelf and give it to you. Now, cryoprecipitate is useful to quickly increase the fibrinogen level in patients with DIC or massive transfusion with hemodilution. It is the third line of therapy for treatment of type 1 von Willebrand's disease, and the second line of therapy in patients with other types of von Willebrand disease. So if somebody's got von Willebrand's disease, this is not the first thing you reach for. If you're asking me what the first thing you reach for is, and then you're saying, okay, what do we give? I would say, well, in that case, probably the first thing you want to reach for is a telephone, because if you're not sure what the first line of therapy is for von Willebrand's disease, and somebody is perhaps having a bleeding problem, you might want to consult or confer with your hematologist. Currently, though, Humate P is the preferred replacement product for von Willebrand's disease. Cryoprecipitate can be used as a source for factor 8 for hemophiliacs, but the preferred product for these patients is the super pure factor 8 concentrates. And a lot of institutions will typically require that these are ordered by a hematologist. Cryoprecipitate can be used to shorten the bleeding time also in uremic patients. People who have an elevated BUN, their platelets don't nearly work as well as they can, and this is one of the strategies we can do. So if somebody's got a platelet count of 100,000 and they've got a BUN of 100, that uremia is going to make the platelets not work as well as they should. So what I would say is they have a functional thrombocytopenia that if they've got 100,000 platelets, maybe only 50,000 of them are actually working. Complications of transfusions. This seems to be something that we should all know something, or at least quite a bit about. And I think what happens is we get kind of cavalier in our use of blood products. We're not ordering IV fluids here. And if you've heard some of my other talks, you know that even an IV, giving somebody IV fluids is not something I take for granted, because certainly giving people fluids has its known complications. But blood products particularly have some very serious complications. Probably the most feared is that of the hemolytic transfusion reaction. It really comes in two varieties, the immediate and the delayed. The immediate transfusion reaction, patients will have fevers, hypotension, back pain, oliguria. You could see their start getting pigment in their urine. In severe cases, patients will have DIC. Most often, this is caused by a ABO incompatibility, and it used to be a classic question to say, well, what was the most common cause of an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction? And the most common cause was defined as clerical error. Somebody misread a label, misread a name, and the patient got basically blood that was not cross-matched properly. And this is the most common cause of death related transfusions. Now, the delayed transfusion reaction is really, you see a lack of expected rise of the hematocrit. Patient will have fevers. You'll have a Coombe-positive hemolytic anemia and jaundice. And if you're giving somebody blood after transfusion, they're going to be Coombe's positive. It's just the hemolytic anemia is the other element of this. Reactions are caused by recipient antibodies attacking the donated red blood cells. This results in a release of the hemoglobin and the red blood cell membrane antigen complexes. Now, when you have free hemoglobin, that is nephrotoxic. It results in precipitation in the renal tubule, so you need to kind of keep those people flushed, try to maintain the urine output greater than 100 an hour. Obviously, there's somebody you're thinking having a transfusion reaction. Stop the transfusion. Take the blood down. Hospitals will have a transfusion reaction protocol where you'll re-cross-match the patient, draw blood from the patient, take the blood that you draw from the patient and setting it back down to the blood bank where they'll try to re-cross-match the patient. Now, febrile reactions, again, are probably the most common thing we see when we transfuse patients. This is most often due to the presence of white cell debris and cytokines in the donated blood. Patients who have had a febrile reaction should get future transfusions either with blood derived from Leuk pore filters or blood that's leukodepleted at the blood center. And basically, it makes sense when you think about it. I mean, white blood cells are rich in HLA antigens, and whenever we can remove the white blood cells, we're going to perhaps make the transfusion of blood products a little bit less eventful. Because transfusion reactions present with a similar clinical picture, again with febrile reactions, all patients with fever during a transfusion really need a transfusion reaction workup. Transfusion-related acute lung injury, I've recently seen an article on this where they're considering this to be perhaps one of the most common complications of transfusions. And this is a non-cardiac pulmonary edema. The typical picture is that of hypoxia, fever, bilateral infiltrates, and hypotension developing 2 to 4 hours after blood is given. I've certainly seen many cases of transfusion-related acute lung injury. You may hear it be called trolley, and that's just the T-R-A-L-I. Ventilator support is often required. Recovery is usually rapid and typically complete, but some of these patients could have a really severe case of ARDS. It's felt to be a form of ARDS caused by the presence of these HLA antibodies in the donor serum, leading to destruction of host granulocyte and activation of the complement system, leading to basically an upregulation of the inflammatory cascade, leading to the lung injury. Another complication of transfusions is the transfusion-related graft versus host disease. This is rare, but it is deadly. It occurs typically when donor lymphocytes attack the blood recipient. It's so you've got lymphocytes in the transfused blood, and those lymphocytes then begin to attack the person receiving the blood. It's very rare in normal blood recipients unless the donor and the recipient share an HLA haplotype. This transfusion-related graft-versus-host disease is reported in blood recipients with immune suppression, mainly patients with Hodgkin's disease and leukemia. Strangely enough, this does not occur in individuals who have AIDS. The symptoms include erythematous rash that may progress to epidermal, what we call toxic epidermal necrolysis, which in the burn unit we actually see quite a bit. We actually had a patient a few months ago who we were consulted with the hematologist who had this transfusion-related graft versus host disease, and it was horrible and it was very tragic. You can see liver dysfunction and pancytopenia. Transfusion-related graft-versus-host disease is prevented by using radiated blood products to patients who are at risk with we could talk about how they radiate the blood, but directed blood donation from all blood relatives should also be radiated as well. So we see this a lot in orthopedics. Do what's called directed donor, have your family donate the blood because you're having your hip replaced. I did this with my son, my youngest son, when he was 4 months of age. He had some pretty significant cranial and neural surgery that was done, and I did some directed donor blood for him, and then as a relative, we should radiate his blood. The interesting thing is that transfusion-related graft-versus-host disease cannot be prevented by the use of lukewarm blood. The irradiation of blood is performed for only one reason, and that's to prevent this transfusion-related graft-versus-host disease. Patients with HIV infection do not get transfusion-related graft-versus-host disease, and therefore they don't need irradiated blood. Then we talk about lukewarm blood. What is that? Well, we talk about the white blood cells containing blood products that may have adverse effects. We talked about febrile transfusion reactions inducing HLA alloimmunizations, immunosuppression, disease transmission, and graft-versus-host disease. Reducing the white blood cells can reduce the incidence of these complications, with the exception, again, of that transfusion graft versus host disease. Currently, white blood cells are removed by infusion through filters that trap the white cells. This can be done at the bedside, at the point of transfusion, in the blood bank, or when they actually accept the blood from the donor. Currently, the indications for leukodepleted or lukewarm blood are the prevention of febrile transfusion reactions in patients with a previous documented reaction. Next would be prevention of HLA alloimmunization, and it's ineffective if patients receive one or more blood products not leukodepleted or the patient's already HLA alloimmunized. And certainly in the prevention of CMV infection, which is really important when you're talking about immunosuppressed patients or transplant patients. Now, what are some of the infectious complications related to transfusions? Perhaps the one that most patients are probably the most terrified of is HIV. Now, with better screening, the risk of transmitting HIV is about 1 in 2 million. However, worldwide, this is much more frequent due to the lack of donor screening. Hepatitis is the classic transfusion-related disease. Since the introduction of a diagnostic test for Hep C, the estimated risk is less than 1 in a million. Surprisingly, the most common hepatitis transmitted by blood is hepatitis B, due to the low titer of highly infectious viruses early on in the infection. Other infections you can get through transfusions include things like syphilis and malaria. At the start of the West Nile virus epidemic, there was a cluster of transfusion transmitted cases, but this has subsequently disappeared with the development of a test assaying for West Nile virus in the blood. Another problem with infections that can be transmitted through transfusion is cytomegalovirus, or CMV, and approximately 50% of the population has evidence of prior infection of CMV. After infection, CMV remains latent in the white blood cells, or the leukocytes, and transfusion of these cells from a previously infected donor can cause infection in the recipient. Now, so we have a patient, they are CMV positive, that CMV virus becomes latent in the white blood cells, you transfuse blood and white cells to a CMV recipient, and then therefore you risk making that patient CMV positive. However, only about 1 to 5% of products that are positive for CMV can actually transmit CMV. CMV infection is usually asymptomatic or may cause mild flu-like illness, but in immunocompromised patients, it can cause severe illnesses, including pneumonia, hepatitis, and bone marrow suppression. A woman I used to work with actually lost her life following a kidney pancreas transplant when she acquired CMV. Therefore, immunocompromised patients, such as premature infants, transplant recipients, patients who have congenital immunodeficiencies or AIDS, should receive blood at low risk for transmitting CMV. Now, the entire topic of massive transfusions can really be an entire discussion all in itself. And unless you're working with patients who have a GI bleed or trauma patients, you're probably not going to have the opportunity to experience the fun of giving patients massive transfusions. And what really defines a massive transfusion is really when we're talking about people who are requiring a whole body or a blood volume transfusion in a period of 24 hours. And quite frankly, we're really talking about patients who can get a whole body transfusion in the period of 1 to 2 hours, and that's typically a massive GI bleed, a cirrhotic who's bleeding from an esophageal varice, or something like a gunshot wound. There are really five tests that we can measure, the hematocrit, the platelet count, the PTT, and fibrinogen level. Perhaps even a better test to assay the development of a coagulopathy in these patients is the use of a thromboelastogram, which is really a bedside test that gives you a graphical output of not only the development of the clot, but the actual intrinsic initiation of fibrinolysis. This is a very helpful test, and those people who they're frequently used in transplant situations by anesthesiologists and people who learn to get pretty savvy with this test really learn to rely on it very heavily. When you have somebody who's massively bleeding and you're trying to transfuse them, you really get into what point do I start giving them blood. And hematocrit, you have to keep in mind, is a concentration. And using hematocrit as a marker of volume status will really get you led down the wrong path. If you keep in mind that if I took a person and took them and measured their hematocrit, and their hematocrit was say 35, and then for some reason I phlebotomized that patient, or I shot that patient, and they lost half their blood volume on the street immediately, and we stopped the bleeding, and we took another hemoglobin and hematocrit, well, what would their hemoglobin and hematocrit would be? Their hematocrit would be unchanged, but what would their blood volume would be? Their blood volume would be the same. Well, why is that? Well, if you think of a bottle of Pepsi, and that bottle of Pepsi or Coke has a certain concentration of Coke or Pepsi, and then I empty out half the bottle. Well, is the bottle half empty? Yes. Is the concentration of the sugar or whatever I want to measure in there changed? Well, the answer is no. Well, the concentration will drop as I add fluid to it. So if I take our patient who I've shot or we've phlebotomized and they lose a large portion of their blood volume and we let them sit there or we transport them and then we draw their hemoglobin and hematocrit, what is it? Well, it's dropped. Why is it dropped? Well, it's dropped because they move fluids from the interstitial space into their intravascular space. Tom Shires back in the 60s did some landmark studies looking at dogs who were bled into shock, and they found at that point that when we bleed somebody into a state of hypovolemic or hemorrhagic shock, that they did better when we administered not only the shed blood volume but also crystalloid. And the idea is that when you're resuscitating a patient from hemorrhagic shock, you're not only trying to increase the fluid in the intravascular space, but you're also resuscitating the interstitial space in the intracellular space. So when a patient loses a significant amount of blood volume and they're not volume resuscitated, the body will actually try to auto-resuscitate itself by moving fluid from the intracellular and the interstitial space into the intravascular space. One thing you have to keep in mind that if you're doing massive transfusion, a lot of hospitals have initiated massive transfusion protocols. And the reason why this is developed is because it's very easy to just keep in mind that I'm losing blood and keep people ordering packed red blood cells. But from what we've already talked about, packed red blood cells is not rich in things that make your blood clot, namely things like plasma and platelets. So in those situations where you've got massive transfusion protocols in place, these can vary. It can vary to where you're using whole blood. And again, as I've said, there's been some excellent presentations at the American College of Surgeons meeting last year by some of the trauma centers in the United States, as well as the U.S. military experience by using whole blood in the cases of massive transfusions. People will do a 1-to-1-to-1 type protocol, which for every unit of packed blood cells, you're administering a unit of platelets and you're administering a unit of FFP. And basically what you're doing is you're administering whole blood, because remember what we talked about is that when we break apart the blood, we're taking each unit of whole blood has one unit of platelets, one unit of plasma, and one unit of packed red blood cells. So by using a 1-to-1-to-1 strategy, you're basically physiologically administering a whole unit of blood. Third type of protocol that you may see is that they'll use thresholds, and for a threshold of so many units of packed red blood cells, that once you've hit that threshold, say of 6 units of cells, then somebody will start administering platelets and FFP. The key thing to keep in mind is that make sure you're not in a situation where you find that your patient's been given 8 or 10 units of red blood cells and nobody's given platelets and nobody's given FFP. That's just not acceptable, and we can certainly do that better. I hope you've learned a little bit from this talk on blood component therapy. It's by no means meant to be exhaustive. There's a lot more that we can talk about. I have done a podcast on what are some our thresholds for providing blood transfusions, particularly in the setting of the ICU. If you have questions about that, I would refer you to that podcast. Once again, my name is Jeff Guy from Vanderbilt University. My website can be found at www.burndoc.com. We do have some articles there and links to other types of things that we do, and you can certainly get a hold of me and email me through that web portal. Those of you who are sending me email, giving me feedback, I do appreciate that. It's nice to hear that people appreciate the podcast and find them useful. My name is Jeff Guy. Have a good night.